Everybody, and welcome back to another edition of the BA Sales Kennel Kelp Holistic Healing Hour. Welcome one and all. Some of you by our invitation, where applicable. My two church mice, Peter and Paul, forever and always. Ubiquitous audience, one and all, however you got here and continue to do so, please. We are growing exponentially with your help, paying it forward. Quick internote, please do start to interact. With all due respect, we're trying to get a little bit more activity at the message boards of the show, to including today. If you have any questions about Byron, who my guest here for, hard to believe it's going to be the sixth time, but the first time in this new calendar year. So I want to segue right in, because we have an action-packed one. They're all action-packed, but we're going to let Byron kind of go right for it here in a second. And I do want to go back to his bio real quickly here, because it's so important. And this is from his website, byronathene.com, from his About Us page, of course, verbatim. And here we go. General perspective: I have an unshakable belief in the unlimited capacity of people's ability to heal and improve. This informs my practice as a psychotherapist, life coach, and trainer. I developed a revolutionary new approach that seamlessly integrates ancient philosophy and cutting-edge psychology. I'm a pluralistic practitioner. This means I can use my own approach on a variety of other approaches to assist you on your journey. As a therapist, I will work with you towards restoration and promote psychological well-being and growth. As a life coach, I will facilitate the transformation from the current you to the ideal you aspire to be. Pardon me. In both cases, this means helping you to access the necessary inner resources to experience a greater sense of free will and a higher sense of achievement and fulfillment. His career, quite extensive, I developed a stutter as a child that formed a core part of my personality. I became interested in philosophy and psychology, and in 1991, became an avid reader of books in those fields. Pardon me, I thought about becoming a therapist, but felt my speech would be too much of an impediment, so pursued office jobs and worked for a local authority for over two decades. I stumbled across the growth mindset idea by discovering my own, but realized I still maintained a fixed mindset about my career and my speech. I reconsidered training as a therapist and coach when I no longer saw my stutter as an obstacle. I'm now a counseling psychotherapist, certified mindset coach, trainer, clinical supervisor, and author. I also received the CREA Global Award of Brains with a Z on the end magazine in 2021. It goes on to personal interest. All due respect, please do refer to byronathene.com to edify yourself with.
I am, yes, thanks. So sorry, I didn't. Thanks again for allowing me to share your wonderful platform. It's yeah, I'm really pleased to be here again for appearance number six. Yeah, really pleased. So okay, I've got a tall order today, because I'm gonna try to cram in quite a few things just so I can make my final point a bit more impactful. So I'm gonna talk about the subjective nature of reality, and highlight it by introducing or talking about an idea called rotoscoping. I'm going to describe three prevailing theories of emotion and disprove them all. I'm then going to highlight a more sensible theory of emotion, the baby theory. I'm then going to go through a few stages of emotional development that I believe we went through when we were born to now. And then I'm going to show, I'm going to talk about a few analogies that will help describe some of the illusions created in the second stage. Then I'm going to end with the main analogy, which is the like the I guess, the thrust for the show. It's an analogy centered around the genie lamp. And this genie lamp analogy will really, hopefully, fully explain what's happening every single time we feel bad. So, okay, so let's start with the subjective nature of reality. When I discovered that belief was reality, it's something that I found really difficult to describe. It's almost like our language wasn't really designed to make it easy to have these types of conversation. So I would say, I'll just try to talk to someone. Are you aware that belief is reality? And then we would just be talking, we would be debating for the next 30 minutes exactly what I mean by that, as opposed to the fact that belief is reality. So generally, there's a universal reality or an objective reality that we are all in, but we are restricted to seeing our individual realities or our subjective reality. The idea is our individual or subjective realities should copy the universal reality, the reality that's real, but because of how the process, because of certain aspects of the process, we are in complete control. So we don't just have to copy what's there. We can create something from scratch and then create it and then project it and then treat it as if it's concrete when it's not. It's like it's a purely subjective creation. So I wasn't really sure how to easily describe that to someone until I discovered an animation technique called rotoscoping. Now, usually, and like before rotoscoping showed up, the way cartoons were animated, artists would just draw different frames, put those frames together, and run that film, run the different frames, and then that would I guess produce a somewhat choppy style of animation until someone at the start of the 20th century, I believe, someone discovered a new animation technique called rotoscoping. So that involved shooting live film, then taking each frame of that film and drawing each frame. So then you would have lots of different frames of drawings. So then you would put those drawings together, and that would produce a really realistic and fluid animation style. Like Disney used it for, I think, most of his first feature length films, like Cinderella and Snow White. Those are rotoscoped, and you can tell because the movements are really, really fluid and really realistic. So when I came across this animation style, I thought, wow, actually that's how we perceive. The film is objective reality, universal reality. The cartoon is our attempt to copy that universal objective reality. But because of the details of the process or the aspects of the process, we're never going to actually get access to the film. We're only going to see our already rotoscoped form of it, our cartoon, and that cartoon is going to be concrete. I guess the idea is we would see the film, then we would then use our senses to create a copy of it. But because we don't have to immediately experience something to create a reality based on it, we don't have to see the film to create a version of it. So we can base our cartoon on other people's cartoons, pretty much. So that means then our cartoons or our realities could be completely removed from actual reality because it was based on either unintentional lie or an intentional lie. But if we rotoscope something, it's real to us. It's concrete. It's almost like it might as well be the film to us. So when I first came across this technique, I thought, well, that's how we perceive. That's how we perceive. So I realized that we can rotoscope anything, which means we can make anything concrete. I wanted to talk about rotoscoping first because I wanted to talk about different theories of emotion. These different theories of emotions are things that we've rotoscoped but aren't necessarily part of the objective film that we were copying. So there are three prevailing emotions that I try to talk about first before going over to my theory, which I think is more sensible. It's No one's come close to disproving it. Yeah. So okay. So the first of the three prevailing emotions is the contrast theory. The contrast theory is the idea that bad emotions exist only because without them, our good emotions wouldn't seem as good. So lots of people believe that our bad emotions exist because, so that our good emotions seem better. And that's something that could be disproved quite easily. So some people think the bad emotion has to be there to enjoy the good. Other people know that the bad emotions don't have to be there to enjoy the good, so they can enjoy the good without the bad. And some people enjoy things less because of the bad. So the bad spoils the good. So that disproves the contrast theory. And I keep forgetting to say as well, I think, Bill, in one of your shows, I think one of your prelude shows, you described the contrast theory, and I didn't realize that there is a sort of a psychological theory out there called the contrast theory about education, and that's not the contrast theory I was talking about. I didn't realize that there was already a contrast theory. My contrast theory is different to the one that you described. Okay. So yeah, I intended to make that kind of correction maybe in episode 3 or 4, but I kept on forgetting.
I think you did make that correction.
I didn't think I did. I thought I consistently forgot to make it. But anyway, okay.
We're both crazy. But continue. I tease a little bit.
Okay, so theory number two is the function theory. And that is, our bad emotions exist only because in certain situations they serve us better than our good emotions. And that theory is true, but only for one emotion in one specific circumstance. It's true for fear in a specific circumstance of your life actually being in danger. So if your life's in danger and you're feeling frightened, that fear is going to help you because it should enable you to access adrenaline. And that adrenaline is going to help you run faster or fight harder. So in that circumstance, being fearful is definitely helping you more than not being fearful. But if you're relaxed, you're not going to have the energy or power to get yourself out of danger. But in every other situation, your fear isn't helping you because our bad emotions affect our clear thinking. So you can be in a mildly risky situation, but be feeling fearful, not think clearly. And because you're not thinking clearly, you could be putting yourself in danger. So it's definitely not helpful in most situations. So that's how the function theory can be disproved. Even if our bad emotions did have a function, that function is now obsolete. So it used to be useful, but it's not now. So it's useful in babies, but it's not useful in adults. Or the function was never universally helpful, but we've managed to find uses for it. It's like some people find their bad emotions are motivational,
correct,
but other people haven't needed to use their negative emotions to be motivational. They can be motivated by other things. So okay, so that's the second theory, function theory. Then the third theory is the inevitability theory, that bad emotions are just inevitable, which can be easily disproved because it's not about you seeing a bad event and then being forced to having a negative emotional reaction to that bad event. It's all about how we interpret. So it's all about how we rotoscope. So if we rotoscope something bad, then we're probably going to, or if we rotoscope something seemingly negative, we're probably going to have a negative emotional response to it. But we could rotoscope using the same data, using the same film aspects, we could rotoscope something completely different. So we could rotoscope something neutral or good instead of that bad thing. So I think that proves that, or that shows that the inevitability theory isn't true. So I try to disprove those three prevailing theories because then that allows me to talk about a theory that just makes more sense. And that theory is the baby theory. The baby theory is the idea that we feel bad or we feel negative emotions. And yeah, by negative emotions, I mean the emotions that most people agree aren't nice or comfortable, or the feelings that most people agree are uncomfortable, like embarrassment or anger or sadness. Because I know some people say, oh, some so-called negative emotions are good in some way, like it's good to feel bad and cry sometimes, but that's what I call negative emotions, ones that most people generally agree aren't comfortable. So those negative emotions exist only because we needed them as babies to alert someone that there was something wrong. So a baby usually feels good, or ideally a baby's going to feel good. So a baby's usually going to be in a state of equilibrium because their needs are being met. So there's not a problem with the food. There's not a problem with the temperature. That feels good. If there is a problem with the food or temperature, that doesn't feel good. So that triggers a state of disequilibrium. And because a baby can't communicate that there's something wrong in any other way, they just report that they feel bad by crying. So that's them sending a distress signal pretty much, so that a caregiver or someone else can come along, tend to them, find out the need that's not being met, meet it, and that returns the baby to a state of equilibrium again. So a baby uses that process to ensure that their needs are met as quickly as possible, and it works more times than not. There's a very high success rate. Now, we adapt the process slightly when we're near newborns, when we start to have desires. And so we then make ourselves feel bad when there's an unmet desire, so that we start acting in a certain way. And because we're acting in a certain way, someone's going to come along and see what's wrong and ideally give us the thing that we're crying about. So that's a very effective process. And we were never taught that that's what we were doing. So we grew up thinking that, well, bad emotions are just a part of life. Like it's life forcing negative emotions on us, as opposed to being taught as early as we can acknowledge that that bad emotion is coming from within. So hopefully that's a good enough description of the baby theory. But
it's great. Okay. And for everyone's quick edification, I believe we highlighted that point quite extensively. I think it was episode 2 and/or 3, the baby theory.
I think that's episode 1.
From the get go. So I stand corrected. Continue.
So that's the baby theory. So let me talk about the different stages of emotional development that I believe we go through. So stage 1 is the newborn baby, or stage 1 is the baby aged between 0 and 3 months. So the baby's just arrived. So in this first stage, the baby only has good sensations and bad sensations. Like I said, it feels good when all the needs are being met. It feels bad when there's at least one need not being met. Now, the baby doesn't have to do anything to feel bad. The senses will just reflect a less than ideal environment. So if a baby's in a cold room, it doesn't have to do anything. It will just feel that the room is cold. It will feel bad, start crying in the hope that someone is alerted, and then make changes. So adjust the temperature or put more clothes on the baby. They'll do something so that equilibrium is restored. So that's the first stage. Right. Baby's feeling just bad sensations and good sensations. Bad sensations when there's an unmet need, good sensations when all of the needs are being met. So that's stage 1. That's the baby theory at its most pure form. Now, stage two is where the magic happens. Stage 2 is somewhere between 3 months and 18 months, give or take. So this is where the baby starts to become a bit more social. So in stage 1, comfort is heaven. A baby is just concerned with being comfortable in stage 1. It's heaven. It doesn't want anything else. It doesn't need anything else. Right. But in stage 2, when it starts to become a bit more social, it starts to look for something else. It starts to want something else. And so this is the start of the first of the four illusions that are created. And these illusions are ones that we are all still falling for. So this first illusion is the illusion of better. So like I said, a baby's comfortable, but it wants something better. It wants comfort plus. So it sees something and thinks, well, that thing over there is better than what I've got. And so it then tries to get it. And this idea of better is completely arbitrary. A baby can be like sat somewhere, maybe it can see another location and think, oh, it'll be better if I was over there. So then it might do something quickly so that someone picks it up and moves it. It can be like happy for a while. It then looks around and sees the original location. Then it thinks, it'll be better if I was over there. So it's just better is completely arbitrary. And it's summed up by the grass is greener.
Right.
Proverb. Yeah, the grass is greener. So the baby thinks, yeah, that grass over there is greener. And but it doesn't stop there. That's the first of the four illusions. So the baby sees something that it thinks is better. It then believes that it needs that thing. It doesn't just want it, it needs it. Because if it needs it and it doesn't have it, it can act in a certain way that will prompt someone to come along and give it the thing. So baby then responds to the illusion of need. The illusion of need is followed by the illusion of bad. So the illusion of bad is quite a tricky one to talk about, because the bad sensation itself isn't really an illusion. The illusion aspect comes from, it's the baby creating the feeling of discomfort. So like I said, in the first stage, when there's an unmet need, there's a naturally occurring bad sensation. And the baby tries to get that thing that it needs in the same way as, or that desire met in the same way as its needs. But because there isn't a naturally occurring bad sensation when there's an unmet desire, the baby has to create it. So that's the birth of bad emotion. The baby is pretending to be hungry or too hot or too cold. The baby has to pretend in a very convincing way. Like, you know, there's a left and right hemisphere. And this isn't sort of physiologically correct, but I say it in this way just so it helps people to understand. So let's say when there's an unmet need, the left hemisphere detects it, the baby feels bad, it cries. When there's a desire, that's created in the right hemisphere. So the baby then makes itself feel bad. It introduces to itself an uncomfortable neurotransmitter. And because the left and right hemispheres aren't communicating with one another, the baby believes that that bad feeling is coming from somewhere out there. It doesn't know that it's doing it itself. So that's how the illusion is maintained. The baby tricks itself into thinking that there's something wrong, because it wants something and it thinks feeling bad. Well, I use the word thinks very, very loosely, since we're talking about a baby. You can't strategize to this extent, but hopefully you know what I mean. The baby does this. So it starts crying in the hope that someone comes along and gives it the thing that it's crying about. And that usually works. Most babies, at least some of the time, get what they're crying about. Usually, so much so that a pattern is created, or a relationship is created between feeling bad and getting your own way. So that pattern is reinforced countless times. And so then the fourth illusion is created, the illusion of control. The baby now believes that they can control their environment just by feeling bad. Because when a baby feels bad, it doesn't have to wait for long until someone comes along and then gives them what they want. So the baby believes that they can control their environment by their feelings. So those are the four illusions. The illusion of better, that so-called better thing isn't better, it's just different. The illusion of need, the baby pretends like it needs this thing as opposed to just wanting the thing. Then the illusion of bad, the baby makes itself feel bad to simulate the sense of, or the state of disequilibrium, so that it starts crying, so that someone comes along and rescues it, gives it what it wants. And that happens countless times. So then the illusion of control is created. The baby believes, because it's worked so many times in the past, that they can control its environment by feeling a certain way. So that's stage two. So stage three is where our desires outweigh our needs. So stage one, it's all about the needs. Desires didn't even exist. Stage two, desires are introduced, but they're not the priority at this stage. Stage three, the desires become the priority. So the desires outweigh the needs. And unfortunately, this is the stage that we are pretty much stuck in as adults. Because when we have an unmet need, I'm talking about just basic physical needs, so food, even if you're tired, temperature, it usually doesn't feel too bad, usually. But if we have an unmet desire, it can feel like the end of the world. We are very good at making ourselves feel bad to the point where we can make ourselves feel like absolute crap if we don't get our own way, subconsciously. So yeah, that's the first stage where our desires outweigh our needs. The fourth stage is where conscious memories begin. So unfortunately, those three stages are trapped within this fourth stage. So we have no idea that we thought comfort was heaven. We have no idea that we made ourselves feel bad to get our own way. We have no idea that that plan then became the priority as opposed to our needs. So I think the idea was we should have been taught about these prior stages, but we weren't, unfortunately. So they remain illusions. Okay, so I do have a couple of analogies that hopefully highlight these illusions, because we've been falling for these illusions our entire lives, pretty much. So they're really, first of all, they're really impossible to see yourselves. And the amount of times I've pointed them out to clients and who see them as I'm talking about them, but then they just go back to their lives and then they just fall for the illusions again, because we have been falling for them our entire lives. So I've created a couple of analogies that will hopefully expose these illusions, because we would need to expose them consistently to not be fooled by them.
Okay.
So there's a magician's trick analogy. Okay, so I'll do it. I'll do it if you know how to build. Okay, here we go. So I'm going to do a trick. So these cards here. Right. So I'm going to take these cards here. Right. I'm going to take them out. Very clumsily. I've been practicing all day as well. Okay. So there's been no more cards. I'm going to take these cards. I'm going to shuffle them. Now, imagine if I was there in front of you, because the cards are going to go out of view only because of the camera's field of view, but there's nothing dodgy happening. I promise, there's nothing dodgy. So I'm going to shuffle the cards nice and slowly. Nothing dodgy happening there. I'm going to cut the pack. And then I'm going to spread the cards out in front of you. I'm going to ask you to pick a card. And the trick is, I'm going to guess the card that you pick. So I know I've sent this to you already, but just pretend that I haven't. So let's see. And you keep disappearing, by the way, Bill. Now there's two versions of you, and both of them are cameraless, it seems. But I'll continue. So, okay. So you pick a card. I don't see the card that you pick. It's the Queen of Hearts. Now, if I said to you, Bill, is your card the Queen of Hearts? You might be a bit impressed. You would know that it's a trick, but you might be a bit impressed because you don't know how the trick works. If I then said to you, if I then overturned all of the cards and you saw that they were all the Queen of Hearts, you wouldn't be impressed anymore, because you would see how the trick works. You're not going to be impressed. It's a really bad trick that heavily relies on a heavily rigged pack of cards. But so you now know how the trick works. But what if I had the barefaced cheek to get another pack of cards, these ones here, and do the exact same trick in the exact same way? Take the cards out, I shuffle them, cut the pack, spread them out, ask you to pick a card. This time you pick the Four of Spades. If I said to you, Bill, is your card the Four of Spades? I'm guessing you would have none of it, because I'm guessing your memory's not that bad. I've just shown you how the trick works. You're not going to be impressed, because you're going to, I'm guessing, assume that all of the cards are the Four of Spades. So this is how I introduce the analogy, or this is the meaning of the analogy. Now that you know about the baby theory, now that you know the reason why we're feeling bad, now that you know about the different illusions in stage two, the illusion of better, the illusion of need, the illusion of bad, the illusion of control, you being wrapped up by your bad emotions, your negative emotions, you falling for the illusions is like being impressed by a magician's trick, even though you know how the trick works. Okay, so that's the first analogy. But it's not that simple, because you are going to fall for the magician's trick, or you are going to be impressed every single time. And this second analogy will explain why. So I'm not sure how much you know about the Second World War, Bill, but I heard a story that blew my mind. I heard it about 15 years ago. I've heard it in a few different places since, but it blew my mind when I first heard it. So I didn't know that there were squads of Japanese soldiers who continued fighting after the Second World War. Like, so the bombs were dropped, Japan surrendered, and they, because these squads were like based in many of the remote islands in the south, in Southeast Asia, it wasn't practical to go down to the islands and inform them that the war was over. So someone must have thought it was a good idea to just fly planes and drop leaflets saying that Japan surrendered, hand yourself in to local air base or naval base, or come home, but your war is over, pretty much. So this squad of soldiers who were told to never surrender, never back down, never give up, one of them saw these leaflets and assumed it was the enemy trying to trick them into surrendering. So they didn't buy it. They didn't buy it. So they continued fighting anyone unfortunate enough to come close enough to where they were stationed. So the Philippine people, because they were based in one of the many Philippine islands, the Philippine people who came across them tried to tell them the war was over. They weren't having any of it. The Japanese government tried other methods to tell them that the war was over. These guys just weren't having any of it. Once, one by one, the soldiers died until there was one person left. He was very good at hiding by now. He must have knew that part of the jungle very, very well. Lots of people had tried to find him unsuccessfully. His story came to the notice of a civilian. He was a journalist, I believe. So he went out to look for this guy. And he managed to find him, even though lots of people tried but didn't. So he approached him and said, "I'm here to let you know that the war is over. It's been over for a while. Please stop killing people." So the soldier said, "Well, I don't believe you." The journalist said, "Well, what will it take?" The soldier said, "Well, since it was my commanding officer who told me to never surrender, never back down, I'm not going to back down. I'm not going to stand down unless my commanding officer tells me." So luckily enough, the commanding officer was still alive. The journalist found him, brought him back to the soldier. He told the soldier to stand down. So the soldier finally stood down, but he had been fighting for 29 years after the war was over. This happened in 1974, 29 years after Japan surrendered. I heard that and my mind was blown. I couldn't imagine that level of commitment, that level of dedication and resourcefulness. It was out like, oh God, yeah. But then when I came across that story, I thought, oh my God, that's like what we're doing with our bad emotions. Because that war is over when we were two. That war is over when we could do things for ourselves. But there's a part of the brain that is committed to making us feel bad, because that's what its job is. And it's very committed to that task. So it needs to be debriefed. It needs to be told, well, you know, you don't have to feel bad anymore to get your own way. There are lots of other methods that you can do. Feeling bad shouldn't be psychological self-harm to meet your desires, shouldn't be the continued plan. But we don't get that authority that says, well, you can stop feeling bad now. Thanks for your service, but there are other things we can do. So I talk about these analogies, and I suggest my clients to create their own analogy, because that will be the equivalent, I think, of a commanding officer. Because if they tell them, I could tell them more analogies, and I will, especially the big analogy that I asked to come on the show to explain. And analogies could resonate with them, but the analogy that's going to resonate most will be an analogy that they create themselves. So I encourage my clients to create their own analogy, because that will come from their level of understanding. It will be in their own language. It should carry more weight. So yeah, so that's what I do. So okay, so I realize that the time's running out. So I'll jump to the main analogy now. So okay, so let's go back to stage two. Stage two. So stage two is when the baby realizes, or the baby, again, I use the word realize very, very loosely. The baby starts to do something different, and that is pretend to feel bad to get their desires met in the same way as their needs. They got their needs met because they felt bad, but that was a naturally occurring bad sensation. When there's an unmet desire, there isn't a naturally occurring bad sensation, so the baby has to create one. That means that a baby acts in a certain way, it starts crying, that attracts the attention of a caregiver or caregivers or nearby adults or other people who can meet the desire. And that's a very effective strategy. So the analogy that I find most impactful is to say that that's the equivalent of the baby having a genie lamp. So the baby has a genie lamp. It can have a wish. It rubs the genie lamp, which creates a feeling of great discomfort. It then starts to cry. That prompts the genie to appear. And at this stage, any wish the baby has can be granted. We're talking about really, really simple wishes like being picked up or being touched or being moved or having things dangled in front of them. These wishes are really, really simple. So the first wishes that the baby have, the caregivers can usually grant immediately. So it's the genie lamp becomes a very effective way of getting their desires met. But as the baby grows up, as the child grows up, the genie lamp becomes a lot less reliable because their wishes outgrow it. So they start to have wishes that the caregivers can't meet. Like they might wish to not go to school, or they might wish to have, like, I don't know, 40-hour days or something. But yeah, so the wishes can't be granted. So the genie becomes less and less reliable until there's a point where the genie moves out altogether. So the genie's not even in the lamp anymore. So it's now a broken lamp. But we still rub it. Every time we have a wish, we're rubbing that lamp, creating the discomfort, but we're not going to get the wish. But we're definitely going to get the discomfort. That's what our bad feelings are. Our bad feelings, every bad emotion is a reflection of an unmet wish. So that's the analogy that my clients have found more useful, because it just draws together so many different aspects of the baby theory, and it's just nice. It's something nice and simple to talk about. And because of that, I've kind of bought my own reminder, because I'm still rubbing the lamp. I know about it, but I'm there every now and again rubbing it. But I know I'm doing it, so I don't do it as often. And when I do, I'm not falling for the illusion. I'm still rubbing a lamp because it's such a deeply embedded condition response. But I'm just aware of it. So that's the analogy that I think my clients find more useful, and I definitely find it the most useful.
That's an excellent analogy. Excellent analogy.
Oh, thanks.
So continue, or if you want to interject into the questions wherever you're at this stage.
That's it.
Okay, great.
Let's get some questions.
Okay, great. So I'll let you. You do have that copy that I sent you?
I do. Yes.
A real quick caveat for everybody's sake, and I think we're golden. I have been getting some messages from the studio. They are having some internet connections difficulties. So as Byron goes through these questions, if there seems to be a pause, because I think I've remained on camera the whole time, I think. If there is a pause, like in my response, it's because of the interference. So Byron, if that happens, if it seems like, hey, is this guy awake? Just go ahead and self-answer them. Just in case that happens, I just thought I'd let everybody know. Byron, please go ahead. And I'm going to attempt to chime in on the answering, and we'll all hope that none of that happens, what I just said. Continue, Byron. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Just to say, from my point of view, you disappear for a while. Right now, there are three versions.
And we should get that rectified in post-production. And one more time, if the audience is hearing this after post-production, and I think that probably will get filtered out, just to...
Okay. All right. Okay. So let's try to get through as many questions as possible. Okay. So the first one was, excuse me. First one was, can you elaborate on why the baby theory applies to all instances of bad feelings, even situations outside of immediate needs? So I think the baby theory applies to all bad feelings because although it used to be used to ensure that our needs were met, we adapted the process to then meet our needs and our desires. So the bad feelings that we feel when there's a need not being met is different to a bad emotion. So if there's an actual need not being met, so if you're hungry, that's a negative physical sensation. Whereas when there's a bad desire, when there's a desire not being met, then that's a bad emotion, because that's the thing that we are creating ourselves in a hope that, well, in a subconscious kind of hope that someone out there is going to do something and meet our desires. So that's why this applies to all bad feelings. So the bad sensations are there to meet our needs. The bad emotions were there to meet our desires. Okay, right. So the next question was, how can we overcome the natural tendency to blame external factors for our bad emotions when the baby theory suggests they originate within? Yeah, so this is not just the baby theory that says that our emotions, good or bad, are generated from within. I think that's a generally accepted idea now, that our feelings are self-generated, good and bad. So happiness comes from within, in the same way that unhappiness comes from within. So yeah, so the baby theory just explains what we did with that. So the bad sensation was felt from within, I guess, even though it might have been an external pressure or an external force. We felt it, and then we cried, and then someone came along and ideally resolved the thing that we were crying about. So made an adjustment of some kind. But the bad emotion is entirely internal. So it's us saying, well, I want to feel that neurotransmitter over there. And then I'm going to feel that neurotransmitter over there. We're really good at making ourselves feel bad relative to the thing that we're feeling bad about. So usually the pattern is, the more we want something, the worse we make ourselves feel. So which true. which is why grief and bereavement feel so horrible and last as long, right, as they do, because, right, we're not going to get that change. We want the person to be here, and they're obviously not going to return. So
correct.
Yeah. Okay. What are some practical exercises or techniques we can use to identify and challenge the illusions fueling our negative emotions? So yeah, like I said, the analogies.
Correct.
We need to expose these illusions as comprehensively or as consistently as possible, or we are going to continue falling for them. We have been falling for them pretty much our entire lives. So unless we make that conscious, consistent effort, we're going to continue falling for them, because they are extremely convincing.
Perfect.
Extremely convincing. Perfect. To the point where we are convinced that that thing is better. When how many times have you thought something was going to be better, we actually experience it and it's not? Lots of times, I imagine. Like loads of
too
times.
Many, every too single too time... many, actually. Too many.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But still, we still fall for it. Exactly. We still have that better stamp, and we just stamp it on things almost indiscriminately. And yeah. So, and the illusion of need. How many times do people use the word need when they're talking about it?
So true.
It's not something they need. It's just something they want, but they feel justified. No, it's my needs are not being met. It's a desire. Come on, it's a desire. And ironically enough, as well, it's kind of just there's some irony in this, because if you were to treat that thing as a desire, you'd be much more likely to meet the desire. Because if you say something's a need, you're going to probably put pressure on yourself to get it, because you're saying this is really important. So you're going to be, you think it's a demand. You might put stress and pressure on yourself. And so that will decrease the chances of your need being met. But if you think it's just a desire, you're going to be feeling more relaxed. You're going to be feeling more resourceful. You're going to be more likely to solve problems if they come up. So you're more likely to get a desire met. So there's the irony in that, like the needs versus desires. We're much more likely to actualize our desires than our needs, usually. Okay. Can you explain the biological basis for the emergence of desires and the subsequent creation of bad emotions in stage two? So, I guess I kind of said this already, but I'll say it in a slightly different way, because this is a good point. This is a good question. So the biological basis stems from the fact that in stage one, disequilibrium feels bad. Disequilibrium is the natural sensation of us being out of balance, and that feels bad. That feels bad, and that had to feel bad, because how else would our caregivers know that there's a problem of some kind? There would have to be, I don't know, mind readers, or I don't know. They would need some sort of psychic power to know that there is something wrong if a baby didn't feel it and then communicate the feeling. So because it was such a foolproof technique, because it usually that bad sensation expression, because it got such a swift response, usually we adapted it to then get our desires met. So then we create a fake sense of disequilibrium to get our desires met in the same way that our needs got met. Okay, so what are some real life examples of how we fall prey to the four illusions in our adult lives, both personally and in relationships? So I'll go through this again. The illusion of better. How often do we think something's going to be better? I mean, it's not. It's better is just different. We can tell ourselves a story and we can think, oh no, actually it is better because blah blah blah. But someone else could tell themselves another story and come up with a justified reason for thinking that thing is worse. It's about the story, not the objective thing, I think. The illusion of need, same thing. We usually use the word needs, but when I say needs, because I'm not taking anything away from people who use needs differently to the way I use it, but I use it to mean if this thing wasn't there and if it continues to not be there, we're going to die. That's what I would refer to as a need. So I'm just talking about physical things. So I'm talking about nutrition. I'm talking about temperature to the point where we can't continually experience too much of either extreme. So we can't go too long without sleep. Those are what I call needs. Then the illusion of bad. Every time we feel bad, that bad feeling is self-generated because of an archaic program we're still running. We can easily stop feeling bad by looking at things from a more empowering perspective. And we can definitely start that by acknowledging that if we feel bad, it's coming from within. We are making ourselves feel bad. It's psychological, emotional self-harm, because psychological, emotional self-harm got results when we were babies. So we are unconsciously, unknowingly still running that same program, but we're attributing other things to it. That's my belief. And the illusion of control, because when we were much younger, the expression of our emotional states got a prompt response. We believe then we could control reality with the power of our minds. And that's something that hasn't quite left us. Because every single time people feel bad, part of them thinks that bad feeling is going to change reality
Correct.
We think, yeah, we think we've got that control of reality. We consciously know that we don't, or hopefully we consciously know that we don't, but we subconsciously still try. We still try to control reality in a way that's not going to work. That's not going to work. Okay. How can we actively nurture the inner baby mentioned in the analogy, ensuring it doesn't continue to manipulate our emotions through illusion? We honor it. We recognize it. We understand it. We help it develop. We educate it. We help it understand that that we almost need a level of support that we didn't get when we were much younger, when we were like, well, kids. And because of that, we then our brains kind of create patterns that then become concrete. But if we were told earlier, then those patterns wouldn't have been concrete. So if I was helping a child understand that their emotions come from within, if they understood that at an early age, they wouldn't have a problem with it. But me trying to tell it to like a 40-year-old, they're not going to understand it as easily. Potentially, some people do, but others don't. Others think that no, their emotions are a reflection of an external event, which is not true. Can you provide additional examples of situations where we fall for similar emotional illusions in our daily lives? Well, yeah, every time we entertain certain disempowering perspectives, we're falling foul of emotional delusions. Like you could say that there are different types of perspectives you can tell yourself in any given situation, especially if it's a bad situation. You could have a victim perspective, a survivor perspective, and a warrior perspective. The victim perspective, although it has a certain appeal to it, it's very disempowering because you're pretty much saying, I can't cope with this. I don't have any agency. I don't have any autonomy. You want to be rescued because you think you can't rescue yourself. But a survivor story is more empowering because you acknowledge that you do have agency. You can rescue yourself. So you're much more likely to try. The warrior perspective is even more empowering. So you've gone through a bad event. And even though you wouldn't have chosen to go through that bad event, you acknowledge that that bad event has made you stronger. And so you've got even more agency and you're going to use that agency to try to affect change and help yourself and possibly help others in a way that you wouldn't be able to if you were telling yourself a victim or survivor perspective. Okay. What role does mindfulness and self-awareness play in breaking free from the cycle of self-inflicted discomfort? Well, I think that's it. If you're mindful of your emotional reactions, you will be less likely to fall for the illusions. If you remind yourself of what's happening and why, then the trick will then soon start becoming more and more blatant, and you wouldn't fall for it. You wouldn't fall for it. So how can you succinctly explain the difference between objective reality and our subjective perception of it without getting bogged down in philosophical jargon? Like I said, that's a tough one because it seems like our language wasn't designed to tackle these philosophical ideas. They weren't, which is why you can talk about something and then just then spend an hour on a side note because you've just been misunderstood, as opposed to having the precise language that will then just get to the crux of what you're saying, so then we can build from that. So okay, but to answer the question, so all right, so like I said, there's a universal reality that we're all in, and there's a subjective reality that's supposed to be copying. Well, there's universal reality and an objective reality. There's and then there's the subjective and individual reality that we're all in. Our individual realities are supposed to be copying the objective one, but it's supposed to be mirroring. But we're in charge of the process, so we can mirror something that's not there. So we can create something from scratch and it will be concrete if we believe it. It's almost like virtual reality. Like we in our minds, we have like a virtual reality machine that can create any idea, project it outwards, and it's going to be real to us. It might not be real to anyone else, but it would be concrete to us. I believe we have the power to create any reality, but we should only be creating the reality that's there. So we've got the power to create that, but because we've got the power to create any reality, false realities or less subjective realities are being created, as opposed to the objective reality is copied, if that makes sense. Okay. All right. Okay. So can you offer a real life example, something relatable to everyday experience, to illustrate how our internal filters shape our perception of the world? So yeah, different biases explain this. One of the most common biases is confirmation bias. We want to be right. So our brains filter things in a way that tries to maximize the potential of us being right. In terms of confirmation bias, that means that if we have a belief, we're going to be more likely to notice the things that prove that belief and ignore the things that disconfirm it. So yeah, we're more likely to notice the things that confirm it and not notice the things that disconfirm it. It's the same with the negative bias. Negative bias is the idea that if someone said, if 100 people gave you feedback for something and 99 of those people were just gave you glowing reports, one person didn't, it's usual that you'll spend your time thinking about that person who gave you the negative feedback as opposed to the 99 people who gave you the good feedback. And I think that's because the good feedback isn't a problem. It's that doesn't need to be fixed. Whereas the bad feedback, that's the imperfection. That's the thing that we need to fix. So that's the thing that we're going to focus on. And if we're feeling bad, that's our attempt to try and fix it. The bad feeling is us trying to fix it. And yeah, obviously that's not going to work. Okay, so some listeners might struggle to accept this idea. What are some common misconceptions or objections you encounter when discussing subjective reality? How would you address these concerns? So yeah, I think the idea that belief is reality, that's a self-proven idea. Because that's my view. My view is belief is reality, reality is subjective. So I could say that to someone, and if they believe me, great. But if they disbelieve me, that means that they believe something else. And because they believe something else, they're in a different reality. So that's the point I'm trying to make, that our beliefs are our reality. So someone not believing it is proving it by not believing it. So that's a self-proven idea, I think. Okay, so if we don't see objective reality, does that mean truth is relative? How do we navigate subjective experiences to find common ground and understanding? Yeah, truth isn't just relative. Truth is completely created. And some of those truths can be relative if they're like two points or two different versions that one could sort of be in relation to another. But truth can be independent as well. So you could say that something is good or bad compared to an ideal or a standard of good or bad, or you can say something is independent of something and then it will just be that thing. So in that case, it's not really relative to anything. It's just there. So I think we've got the whole range. It can be independent or it can be relative, I think. Oh, really? Okay. You're welcome. Well, thanks. Okay. For sure. Yeah.